All right. Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Looks like we've got a quorum here today. Today is February 26, 2018, and we're going to go a little bit out of order because we're waiting for certain pieces of information to get to us. So we're going to start off with a work session on House Bill 4159 relating to the Individual Account Program of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. John, what do we need to know?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, this measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage. It came out of the House Committee on Business and Labor with a public hearing on February 12th and a work session on February 14th. It came to this Joint Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. On OLIS is a preliminary staff measure summary from Joint Ways and Means, a fiscal impact, and a revenue impact light. The subcommittee may remember that there's some important background pieces on this that the committee heard in January. It was item number 46, the Public Employees Retirement Fund target date fund request, and then the state treasurer's report on February 21st. The measure, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, directs the Public Employees Retirement Board to adopt rules that allow members to choose how their investment individual account program is invested among available options, allows the board to contract with a private provider with exemption from public contracting code for purposes of implementing the change on how the IAP members choose an investment option, requires the state treasurer to notify the Public Employees Retirement Board by December 31st, 2018 if legal or fiduciary standards prohibit implementation. Again, measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage, and there is no amendment to this measure. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
All right, thank you, John. So as I read House Bill 4159, there's a couple of folks who are mentioned in here, both our PERS folks and the Office of the State Treasurer. Does anyone want to share any thoughts on this, or are we good to move this forward? We're good to move this forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator
Johnson. I would respectfully ask for some thoughts. While I have had this described to me as nobody seems to be anxious about it on either side, it would be lovely to have a little reassurance on the record that we've got peace in the valley. And if you would indulge inviting somebody up to say we've got peace in the valley, I'd like to have that on the record.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Come on up. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, I'm Steve Rodman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employee Retirement System. I'm not sure what conflict or exchange you might be concerned about, Senator Johnson. There is a provision in the bill that gives the Treasurer additional time to look at the legal and fiduciary implications of this legislation. I haven't heard of any substantive concerns out of that conversation. I think it's more a question that they haven't thought through as far as the member choice issue, and they want time to think through it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
What happens if they think through it and there's a problem? That's question number one. And question number two, because I was just introduced to this concept half an hour ago, question number two is, how problematic is this in terms of administration?
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, I'll tackle the administrative part of it first. There's provisions in the bill that give her some expedited authority on procurement, and that is language that is carried over from the last time this legislative body created a new program in 2003, the OPSERP and IAP program. There, the bill was passed in August with the January implementation, so we got a little more space. That's appreciated. But it is helpful for us to have that contracting authority so that we know how to have conversations with our service providers and figure out the way in which we would create the mechanism for member choice and how it would be executed. We've already started those conversations, Senator Johnson, as you might expect. And while we cannot lock in, of course, to any particular provider or process until the bill's passed and until we have the procurement authority and we follow the rules that would require, conceptually, it is work that is already done under any retirement plan, or I should say any defined contribution plan, where members go in, make an investment choice, that choice gets recorded and passed through to the investor to ensure that the investments are made in alignment with the choice. So it's not a new idea. It is for us a challenge of finding the partners and having the partners that will work with us to execute those responsibilities. We have those folks now. The company Voya that works with us on the IAP and with our Oregon Savings Growth Plan has the capability and the mechanism to do this. It's just a question of engaging them or another provider if we find a better one to do the work.
One last. Mm-hmm. I understand that the affected population is close to the end of retirement. And you're looking at me like I'm speaking in a foreign language.
Well, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, every IAP member is affected. Every member can choose a target date fund. So it isn't just the folks closer to retirement. That's why the look on my face was what it was.
Okay, well, now I'm giving you the same look back because it was described to me slightly differently. Amazing in this building that there could be a different description. How many in and outs of the pools does a member have? So if you elect to be in a certain risk profile and then 2 weeks later the market drops 1,000 points and you decide maybe that's not such a great idea and then you want to go back to something else, how many in outs do you get in the course of the management of your portfolio?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, it is a once a year election. So the member would make an election as to which target date they want to be placed in for the next calendar year upcoming. And they would be in that target date fund then for that calendar year and perpetually until they made a different election if they chose to.
One last question. In terms of member education, we've just seen recently an incredibly volatile market, and this was one of my big concerns about the Treasurer's retirement plan, was people not being able to differentiate between that retirement savings plan and PERS and thinking that they were getting something they weren't. In terms of education, member education, and to steel them against the vicissitudes of the market, do you see a need to do that as people that may not be tremendously sophisticated investors are chasing market fluctuation?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, yes, member education will be a big part of this. We, of course, have a broad spectrum of folks with their relative knowledge of investments and the volatility inherent in them. And that is frankly one of my concerns and why, again, I look to a particular partner to help us with this, because to the extent that an individual wants to contact somebody to talk through what target date fund should I be in, to my limited understanding, that is investment advice that we are not licensed to give. And consequently, the service provider that we would partner with this has to have that resource available for our members to contact to get the kind of advice that they may need. Now, will all of our members avail themselves of that opportunity? Not all of our members even know they have an individual account. So, as I say, it's a broad spectrum of folks. Senator Johnson, we have already started planning the campaign. Every member gets an annual statement in May. We've already reserved and conceived of what is the May document going to look like if this bill passes. That introduces first the fact that there are target date funds, because this statement will be their first notice, perhaps, that they have target date funds. And then second, what do we start telling them about choice? And then through the campaign in the summer, how do we contact individuals through our newsletter, email distribution list, partnering with the unions and our employers to try to get information in folks' hands? You don't want to get too far into that conversation because you don't have somebody to point them at yet. But we have already started the different levels of conversations and resources we're going to need to make sure our members have the information that they need to make the choice when they want to engage in that question. It is daunting, yes.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair. This was very helpful.
Well, I'm Senator, I'm glad you asked those questions because those were questions I had earlier. I think there's a lot of fine Oregonians who work for the state of Oregon that are very skilled in their craft, in their profession, but investing may not be one of those skills or crafts they have. And so I think it's important that they have a little bit of training opportunity availed to them to understand how this may work. Quick question on that. That training is going to cost money. And when I look at the fiscal impact statement, I'm not seeing necessarily any allowance for that expense. Any thoughts on that?
Sure. Co-Chair Smith, you were kind enough in my last visit to this room to ask me if I would ever be back in front of this subcommittee, not knowing whether today would be today, but certainly in May. That's what I was alluding to, is we need time, of course, to figure out how we're going to do this and come up with the implementation plan and all the elements of it. That is what we've been targeting to, because we don't want to put a number out there that's irresponsible. We need to negotiate and talk to the service providers that would come into that work with us. But in discussions with LFO and CFO, we've forecast that that is our plan. And as an other fund agency, we hope to get their agreement on pre-spending, what we need to pre-spend to be ready by May, and then come back in May and not only backfill if needed, but then put the expenditures in going forward.
Thank you. We'll go to the representative then, to the senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Do you think January 1, 2019 is a realistic target date for having this unrolled?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Marsh, I do think it's realistic given the advance authority we have and the time that we have, and then, frankly, the notice we've had that this would be an initiative that was going to be brought forward into this session. Frankly, with all the other issues coming up in 19, if it's going to happen, we'd rather it happen now.
Okay.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of these plans have individual buckets. You can choose one or the other. So you have a high risk, high yield, medium risk, and then you have these targeted towards a retirement date, which get more conservative the farther you get closer to retirement. Will they still have all those options, or is it going to be just go into a bucket picking a retirement date?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer, target date funds, just in the industry in general, are different sort of asset allocations. As you're nodding, you get that. So what this allows an individual member to do is align their risk tolerance to the bucket that is represented by the target date fund. So for example, if I was somebody who is late in my career, but knowing I have a solid PERS pension and other savings, I want to be more aggressive with my IAP alignment, I can pick a target date fund that would be aligned with someone much younger in my career. And I can dial up the risk, if you will, and the volatility, if you will, but the opportunity for return by putting more of an emphasis on equities. On the other hand, if I was a police or fire member who can retire sooner than 65 and I want to dial back my risk, I can move into a more conservative target date fund.
Just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is you can only pick these funds, so you can pick a earlier or later date, but you aren't going to have the basically the three pools that probably currently exist: high risk, high yield, medium risk, medium yield, low risk, low yield.
Co-Chair Smith and Senator DeBoer, that is correct. You will not have any choice but to pick a target date fund. But on the other hand, members have never had a choice with any investment of their PERS money. IAP, regular account, back to the variable a little bit, but choice has never even been a factor in PERS before. This is the broadest choice people are going to have.
Perfect. Any other questions? All right, Mr. Chair.
LFO.
Oh, we need a recommendation from John. Sorry, I got out front of myself.
Actually, just the motion would be sufficient today. Thank
okay,
you.
The motion. Okay, well, again, we've moved the goalposts again. All right. Mr. Co-Chair, I move HB 4159 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
All right, thank you. The co-chair moves House Bill 4159 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any conversation? Any folks opposed? Seeing none, so approved. Co-Chair Manning, would you carry this one to the full committee?
I would love to.
Thank and then you. I don't know, does leadership, who in the House side, whose bill is this on the House side, do you know? Is this the treasurer's? I just want to make sure we get the right carriers on this.
Actually, it is the treasurer's.
Is this the treasurer's?
This bill, right?
Oh, we'll have Representative Williamson carry it on the House floor. And Chair, why don't you carry it on the Senate floor, if that's all right? Okay. Anything else, John, on House Bill 4159?
No, sir. Thank you.
We're good. All right. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 4159. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1565 relating to methods of public procurement.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Meg Bushman Reinhold with the Legislative Fiscal Office. Senate Bill 1565 directs the Oregon Department of Transportation, Administrative Services, and DOJ to designate a statewide e-procurement system and write rules for that implementation. It creates two sort of pilot programs, one to test reverse auctions and one to test a 30% weighting requirement for price and procurements. DAS is also required to report regularly on the progress of these pilots and the new system to the governor and the Joint Committee on Information Technology. DAS will contract with an independent monitor and also hire four procurement positions to get this off the ground using money from rebates from spots cards for the positions.
Perfect. All right. So why don't we... Following the good senator's counsel, why don't we have DAS come on up and
thank you,
and share some thoughts on this. Well, I also see Department of Transportation. Do they want to? Am I missing this? We'll just hear from DAS. Yeah, sorry about that.
Good afternoon. My name is Barry Leslie, and I am the governor's deputy chief of staff. And with me today is Debbie Dennis, who is DAS's chief procurement officer for the state. I want to first of all thank the committee and thank the policy committee for all of the many conversations we've had on this bill over the last 5 months. Debbie and I feel like we've been just beating down people's doorsteps to talk to us about procurement, and it's not everybody's favorite topic. So I appreciate the fact that everyone has been so patient with our conversations about this bill, which is really important to us. Just a quick preview of the bill, quick overview. We have been, when the governor hired me 10 months ago, after nearly 20 years in state government, she asked me to really give a particular focus on cost containment and efficiency in government. And so we have spent the last year having lots of conversations with DAS and lots of conversations with agencies about where the best opportunities are to accomplish both of those things. Procurement came up over and over and over again. And so in working with Debbie, she sat down with us for hours before we came up with this bill, and we talked through with her, what are some ways we could actually make a difference that would actually possibly save money, do things better, and really help our agencies be more successful? So that is what this bill is. And as you know from the conversations we've had, it really does three things. It takes a pilot project, which has been a pilot, and turns it into a permanent enterprise-wide project, meaning that it would impact all state agencies. And essentially what it would do is allow agencies to track in one unified e-procurement system the $8 billion we spend biennially on buying stuff. And we think that if we know where the money is going, we can probably do a much better job of managing it. So that's part one. Part two is a pilot to try out what they call reverse auctions, which is really an opportunity for us to take a group of qualified vendors and have them compete against each other to see if we can get better deals for the state. So it's sending a message to vendors that we care about every taxpayer dollar and that we want to see that they can sharpen their pencils and do a better job in terms of the price that they're providing to the state. The third part is the 30%. It's another pilot, and it looks at taking how states currently do their request for proposal process and asks agencies to always require that every time they do a contract with an entity, that when they're evaluating all those requests for proposals, that they are evaluating using price as 30% of the criteria. Right now, agencies use anywhere between 5 to 20% for price as their criteria, with an average, I think, of 16. And we think that we should not only be signaling to vendors that price matters when we do contracting, but that also it sends a message to agencies that we want them to be not considering price as every qualifier, but that they're actually using that as a consideration when we're contracting with taxpayer dollars. So that's an overview of the bill, and Debbie and I would be glad to answer any and all questions that you have.
Perfect. Senator.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. You said qualified vendors, and that immediately sets up all sorts of flares for me. How does one get excuse me, onto the qualified vendor list, and are you making certain choices up front by front end loading who gets to play? I would just project against this bill, if the idea is to try to get the best price, you'd want the widest field. Mm-hmm. Let me just take a hypothetical. Let's take a commodity that every agency uses, toilet paper, for example. Well, it's serious. So a new toilet paper vendor comes into Oregon. Great fanfare, state assistance in helping them, and they get settled. They want to make their product available. Under this scenario, how does a new entrant become a qualified vendor to sell something as non-esoteric as toilet paper?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, let me just ask a question, and then I'll turn it over to Debbie to answer. Are you asking under the reverse auction scenario or just the general contracting scenario?
I guess I'm asking under both. I'm trying to figure out, if you're trying to suss out the best price, how do we make sure that we have an open field? When you said that you would do this reverse auction with qualified vendors, I want to make sure that we're not shutting out completely qualified folks who could compete on price if they got a chance to get up to bat.
It's a great question.
Excellent. So, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, for the record, my name is Debbie Dennis, and I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the State of Oregon. When Barry mentioned qualified vendors, that qualification process happens at the time of the solicitation. So we're not referring to some predetermined qualified list of vendors. Through the reverse auction pilot, we would set out, these are the qualifications you would need to compete for this procurement. If it's a goods procurement, it would primarily be around the specifications, for example, of that toilet paper and their distribution channels and whatever the qualifications would be for that procurement. And so anyone who met those minimum qualifications would then be able to compete.
Follow? Mm-hmm. I picked a commodity that every agency uses quite intentionally. Do you let agencies shop independently? So you've got Energy shopping for their toilet paper and ODOT shopping for theirs. And well, I'm trying to figure out, where's the benefit if you go to a new system like this, other than the bid where you're asking price to go as high as 30% as a factor? I'm trying to figure out, How do we ultimately save money if you are allowing agencies to spot purchase for a very low technology, absolutely essential, pretty low price commodity that is needed across state government?
Certainly. Co-Chair Smith, Representative, or Senator Johnson, we have 350 price agreements in place today that are mandatory use. So all the items that we know agencies procure, including toilet paper, janitorial supplies, office supplies, computers, we have mandatory statewide price agreements in place today for those items for agencies to purchase off of, and they're required to purchase off of those. What we don't have is a system that captures all of those purchases so that we can ensure agencies are actually buying from the place that we have mandated they should buy from.
One more follow-up?
Mm-hmm, please.
So let's assume you've got a price agreement and Acme toilet paper is not on that price agreement. First of all, how do they get on the list? I presume they would have to respond, but I don't know how often these price agreements are refreshed. And secondly, if you already have deals with Beta PP manufacturer, how does this new system, which trumps which? Do you void all the current price agreements that you've gotten or negotiated? How long are they in effect for? Do they all void uniformly so that you can put this new program into place with some degree of uniformity? How does that work?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we would not have the bandwidth to void all of our price agreements at one time. Typically, our price agreements are put in place for anywhere between 2 and 5 years, and sometimes we have the ability to renew them for a few years after that. But our standard is 5 years. We usually have an initial term of 2, and then we assess the performance and make a determination whether to extend them or not extend them. As far as what system would do to better help us is we would be able to see how much toilet people are buying and what frequency are they buying it. Right now, we're only able to say we know our state agencies purchase toilet paper, but we really don't know how much or how often. And so if we had the data behind our volumes, we would then be able to say, we can guarantee you that we'll buy, you know, one truckload a quarter of toilet paper, something like that, to be able to negotiate more concrete and specific discounts.
Mm-hmm. One last question. You talked about those consumables that all agencies use, and you mentioned janitorial products. And do you lump those all together so that if I am a toilet paper vendor, I don't make cleaning supplies, and I don't make sponges, and I don't make all that other stuff, how do I get my product in front of the state of Oregon if you're lumping all of the consumables together? Maybe you're not.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we do typically lump solicitations together.
Technical term.
Yes, it is. we typically do lump them together under one solicitation, but then we break it out into categories. And so if a supplier only provides category one, they can submit a proposal for only category one. But if it's a powerhouse supplier, they could submit on multiple.
Okay. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My experience with this type of purchasing isn't the best, especially after you're doing a five-year purchasing when products are changing. So the question is, your local area that they're buying it, do they have the opportunity to see if they can buy locally cheaper, and do they have the ability to go outside of that frame? And the third one is, do you monitor the pricing as opposed to your bulk price?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer. Let's see if I can remember all three questions.
I can
read these. So we do have a process. If an agency finds a good that is offered at a lower price than we have on our price agreement, the process is that they contact our price agreement administrator and let them know, hey, I found that same computer at Office Max down the street for a lower price than your price agreement. What we typically do in that situation is we phone our price agreement supplier and say, hey, you're not competitive at the moment. We'd like you to match this price. Most times they will do that. When they won't, then we grant an exception to the agency so they can go off and purchase the item at the price that's more competitive.
Just to follow up, the car thing which runs through, you purchase your cars. So City of Ashland bought a new Volt. At the time, there were specific rebates that I'm sure you didn't get advantage of. So it seems like they would go to their Ashland dealer and say, here's the price of our car, instead of bringing it in from Portland. Can you beat it? That never happened. And that, to me, you know, the ability of a local agency to have their price that's set by bid, which is great, mm-hmm. but for them to actually ask local business people, what is your price today? Mm-hmm. And if we can beat it, then save them the hassle of going to Portland mm-hmm. and picking up a vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, your case of a computer is very hard to shop. The case of toilet paper is not. Mm-hmm. So we tend to make a big bureaucracy out of something that in some cases could be. I'm curious, is ODOT here? So how does ODOT fit into this, and what's an example of their pricing? We'll talk about the Dutch auction or the reverse auction. I have a different name for it. We use it often. I guess we'll wait till we get to that part. The other part is, so are these companies then going to start paying you 1% to fund this, so you have a toilet paper, and they're going to now add 1% to the price and then send it directly to your office, I assume. Hey, I'm a little bit confused at the whole thing, so I'll leave that with you.
Okay. So, Barry, did you want to take the funding model, or would you like me to?
Go ahead, and I'll
go on. So, Co-Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer, I believe what you're speaking about is the way that the e-procurement system would be funded. And so the proposal that we have on the table would be that for every purchase made on a statewide price agreement, which is just under $1 billion of that $8 billion spend that we've been discussing, a 1% fee would be charged to the vendor who is providing that good or service. There would be no upfront cost to the state to implement the e-procurement system. That cost would all be borne by Periscope, who is the vendor of the e-procurement system. As revenues are generated, they will be shared between Periscope and between the state of Oregon until such time that Periscope has recouped their initial investment. Over time, the revenue share would shift so that the state would be getting a larger portion and the vendor would be, their portion would be reduced over time.
Just one follow-up here, please. Mr. Chair. What is their initial investment?
The initial investment is, it depends on what time period you're looking at. Through implementation, it is about $8 million.
So the model that's being shared with us today, the proposal, has this been utilized in other states or other major municipalities that you could share with us?
Sure. Co-Chair Smith, the model has not been used by this vendor exactly in this way in the past. There are e-procurement systems that are funded by a transaction fee. That's a very common way for states to fund their e-procurement system. The difference in this particular one is that what typically happens is the state needs to come forward, ask for a POP, ask for the funds, and has to expend those funds just like we do with typical IT implementations. And then as the revenue comes back in from the 1% fee, it reimburses the state for their expenditure. And in this case, we would not be making that expenditure up front. The vendor would be fronting the expenditure.
So I think I understand the opportunity before us on this. What's the threat to us?
That's a great question, Senator, or Representative Smith. The threat is not getting that revenue share computed properly and locking ourselves into an agreement where Periscope would be earning a larger portion of that revenue than is justified. And so we have a whole list of considerations. We've not begun negotiation on this. We don't want to take that step until we have approval to move forward. We have their initial proposal, but we have a whole list of considerations that we would need to feel assured about before we could move forward with this deal.
So let me ask one more question, and I appreciate your answers on that. Once we have those considerations, what do we measure those against to make sure that we are getting the best possible deal?
Co-Chair Smith, there would be a few things. First of all, the one thing that's very different about this model than we would get under a traditional model is that all local governments and school districts would have the ability to implement the N10 solution, have the same exact e-procurement system as the rest of the state agencies. And so one thing we would want to be measuring is it would be up to Periscope to be marketing and to be training and to be implementing out to those local entities that were interested. And so that's one thing that we need to come up with a way to measure. And that revenue share over time would need to incent them enough to really want to make this a good solution for all of Oregon, while at the same time not overcompensating them if our localities are not interested.
So last question, then I'll come to start. We want to encourage innovation, and we appreciate this. And every one of us wants this to succeed. What way can we exit out of the relationship should 12 months, 24 months, 36 months from now, this doesn't turn out to be what we thought it's going to be? How do we do that?
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith, that's an excellent question and something that Barry and I have been thinking about long and hard. We, based on the projections that we have in front of us, we know what our current price agreement spend is. So we can estimate what the minimum amount of revenue would be generated is. We have a little more trouble projecting if the system becomes very attractive for a lot of end users, and they're putting more through the system, you know, we're projecting a modest growth. I wouldn't want to enter into this public-private partnership with Periscope for any longer than, say, 5 years. It's going to take them at least 2 years to implement the system and 2 years for them to recoup their initial investment. And so that would give another 2 years or so for us to be measuring how this is going before we make a decision as to whether we want to end the partnership, and then we would just begin to pay an annual SaaS fee and an annual hosting fee, and we would become less of a partnership and more of a customer supplier relationship. And so that's the strategy that we have in mind, is to not extend the partnership for too long where we wouldn't have a way to stop and assess and make decisions about go forward.
Perfect. Thank you. Senator?
It hasn't been an hour since I told you ladies that, based on what you told me, I felt like maybe this was a good innovative experiment. The longer you've talked, the more freaked out I am. first of all, this is a model that this vendor has not utilized before, so we are their test case. I've heard you say that it appears that part of what drives this is the amount of hustle, for lack of a better word, that Periscope puts into it. Our track record with writing these kind of contracts is appalling, and I don't know whose contract we're signing. It seems that we are captive to a vendor, even under your scenario. If this goes badly, it takes them 2 years to implement, 2 years to recoup, and if it doesn't go well, then we're just a customer of Periscope. I don't know what proprietary information they have from us. I don't know how we get out from under a soured relationship. We've got a multi-million dollar lawsuit in our past when we thought we were doing something nifty and innovative, and it turned out very badly. And the longer you guys have talked, the more freaked out I am about the level of risk being put on us. You also seem to suggest that there are some issues that have yet to be fully formed. And I'm asking why, other than the politics, are we jamming this through the 18 short session, arguably within the last 10 days? Could this be more fully developed? Could there be template contracts? Could there be a little more groundwork before the legislature opined? And what would be the downside of waiting until 19 to do a little bit more of a risk or a threat assessment, as the chair characterized it? The kind of overwhelming feeling of being at the mercy of this untried vendor is giving me great pause.
So, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I really appreciate your concerns, and I understand them, which is why Debbie and I have spent a lot of time working through what the potential risks of this could be. What I want to share with you is that this bill is not about the public-private partnership. This is a model we put before you because we're trying to think of ways of doing IT contracting differently, with a reasonable risk, and to do things that state government does really well, and also still allow the private industry to do what they do really well. So this is a part of the concept that we're bringing to you to consider. If this body says we do not like that funding model, there is still a lot about this bill that we really like that doesn't have anything to do with the funding model, and this bill can go forward without this funding model. So I just want to be really clear that I think this bill is really good regardless of the funding model. I still think this funding model is a good thing to continue pursuing, but the basic core of the bill is not all about the funding model. So I don't want the important work of an e-procurement system, of the reverse auction, and of the pricing on the RFP to get lost in that.
Could you split the two for us? Let's assume that the committee is sufficiently unenthusiastic about linking the two.
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through what a bifurcated bill would look like and what residual piece we would be authorizing in this short session, and what work you would do in moving ahead to talk about the price agreement.
So, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, if you did not like the funding model, which is actually, I don't think is actually integral, and it's not a statutory, it's not written out in the bill, you would be essentially authorizing DAS to move forward with the fiscal that puts together the project team to move forward with the e-procurement system, and then they would be returning in 19 with policy option packages for the each agency to thread out what that $8 million looks like to implement the system. So essentially what you're doing is saying, okay, we'd like Des and Debbie can clarify some of the specifics behind this, to go ahead with putting together the e-procurement system as an enterprise project rather than a pilot project, but we're going to pay for it up front ourselves, and we're not going to enter into an agreement with the vendor. We're going to do this like we would a regular IT project.
One last question. How did this vendor come to us? Mm-hmm. Are there others that do this work? And we're talking about these reverse auctions and trying to get the best competitive deal. And it seems to me that we got married to a single vendor, and I don't know how that vendor was vetted.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, that's a great question. We did a formal RFP. And so, as Barry mentioned, there was a grassroots pilot group that got together, nine agencies, back in 2014. They wanted change. They wanted this e-procurement system. And they put together the requirements of what an e-procurement system for the state would be. At that time, it was their only commitment was to implement it for their own agencies with the vision of, at some point, it converting and being the enterprise system. So they did a full-blown RFP. It was led by DAS. There were four vendors, I believe, that competed for the RFP. There were two that rose to the top, and this one was the one that was selected. They were selected back in 2016, and the pilot group has been working with them, and we just kicked off the build out of the backbone of the pilot group at the beginning of this year.
That just invites one more question. Why can't we, as we used to say in the helicopter business, just fly it and watch it? Why don't we let the pilot prove its efficacy before we jump into the deep end with everything?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, another great question. Mm-hmm. In the pilot, it is limited functionality. So each agency, let me back up, ORPIN is our current e-procurement system in our system of record. It's very limited, and we use it to post opportunities so that vendors know what we have to bid on, and we use it to post our procurement awards. Until we replace that system, it has to stay in place. And so nine agencies would be able to automate the way they request purchases and the way they cut purchase orders, but they'd have to interface or jump over to ORPIN to do their public procurement work. And then they could jump back out and post their awarded contracts in the new system. And so we could certainly do that, and that has been the plan, is to see how it goes. But there is an opportunity here to go ahead and replace the ORPIN system and see how this works end to end. This is implemented in eight other states.
Co-chair, by Periscope?
By Periscope, and the city of Portland, I might add.
Mm-hmm. If I could add.
Then what didn't I understand when you said the model, this model has not been done by this vendor previously?
Funding model.
Yes. Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, the system has not been funded with this public-private 1% partnership revenue share. So it's the funding that has not been done before.
But the vendor is been used in many different jurisdictions throughout the country. Mm-hmm.
Do you mind if I ask a follow-up?
I'm done.
As if I hear you correctly, we're going to be moving off of ORPIN, moving mm-hmm. into this new program. Mm-hmm. Will the ORPIN system have any remaining value? And mm-hmm. Let me rephrase that. How long will we continue to use ORPIN until it no longer has any value to the state? Mm-hmm. When will we transition off of it?
Sure, Co-Chair Smith. Thank you for that question. If we were to convert Oregon Buys into an enterprise system, the first body of work would be to replace the ORPIN system. And what that would mean for us is that new solicitations and new contracts that would be awarded would be done in the new system.
In Periscope.
Yes, in the Periscope correct. System. That's correct. And any existing contracts that have a life, you know, we'd have to determine an amount, but say 6 months or longer after implementation, would need to be uploaded into the new system so that we could manage them in the new system. And then ORPIN would be retired, mm-hmm. and it would be available for state agencies and the public to go ahead and do searches and things like that.
Is there any value in that?
There's historical value.
Historical value.
Yeah. So so it's important at times for us to be able to look back and see who bid on these things in the past or what prices were we paying. And so
how long would we need to maintain that before we'd be able to eliminate that mm-hmm. as...
I'd have to do a little bit more research, but I would say 5 to 6 years. It currently resides. That one's not a software as a service, and so it resides on our servers at the state data center.
You know how many state employees are responsible for its maintenance and upkeep?
We have 2 people in my office that are responsible
for that. Oh, is
that
it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask one more question on the new, the Periscope. As you're negotiating through that, I sure would hope there would be a protection in place for the state of Oregon if that relationship doesn't turn out to be what we'd want it to be, mm-hmm. that there's a way for us to one, give us an exit strategy, but to also give us a glide path to an exit to where we're not held hostage by becoming a regular customer and now being forced to a set price amount.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does, Co-Chair okay. Smith. That does make sense, and it's on our sort of list of things that we are keeping in mind. I am actually planning to pull together a team of smart people to pull into the room so that we can prepare to be able to better look at what all of the risks are with this type of strategy.
Let me ask one more question, and then I'll pass over. In the past, one of your very, very able employees, Kelly Molnar Stevens, mm-hmm. has done an excellent job in rural Eastern Oregon of getting out and helping business owners understand how to participate. Mm-hmm. What level of training and outreach are we going to have to rural Oregon to make sure that they know about this new system mm-hmm. and how to transition from ORPIN to Periscope?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Smith, that is another very good question. Periscope would have a team of people here in Oregon, and they would be responsible for most of the outreach on the technical use of the system.
Let me be really matter of fact. How are you going to make sure they're in Ione, Oregon?
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to make sure
Periscope, who's located mm-hmm. somewhere, is in Ione, Oregon? Making sure folks know about this?
Yes, that's a great question, Co-Chair Smith. We will have a service level agreement with them, mm-hmm. and that is a conversation we've already started with them that we want to be driving when it comes to prioritizing which areas of our state and which localities they are outreaching to. We don't want them in the driver's seat telling us which localities they want to stand up on the system first. We need a voice in that.
And what's the penalty if they don't show up in Ione?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lose their contract.
Yeah. Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, those are all the things that would have to be negotiated into the service level agreement.
Boy, am I not comfortable with this. Mr. Chair, if you're planning on moving this, I want to alert the Senate President. He's going to need to come down here.
I'm a good soldier, Senator.
I'm going to go call the Senate President.
Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. So I'm curious as to how this works with IT projects, both of the pilots. Are you expecting IT projects to participate in the reverse auction and in the 30% price agreement there?
Representative Nierman and Co-Chair Smith, I'll answer the easy part first. And that is on the 30%, yes. All procurements, all RFPs that are valued over $150,000, the 30% weighting will come into play as we make our final award determination. As far as the reverse auction goes, by this bill, we're obligated to identify 10 procurements over the pilot period. And I would anticipate at least one would be IT, but not knowing what's going to come, you know, into our office, I'm not certain exactly how many.
Good.
Yep, please.
So the Office of the State CIO has some procurement software called Basecamp, and I'm not all that familiar with it, although it comes up every now and then. Are you aware of that? And then does your software play nice with that or talk about that?
Mm-hmm, sure. Co-Chair mm-hmm. Smith, Representative Nierman, I am absolutely aware of Basecamp. Mm-hmm. Basecamp is a joint program between the State Procurement Office and the Office of the State CIO.
Oh, good. I'd hope you'd know
yes.
about it then.
It's actually a a program, not in terms of an IT system. Basecamp, they have a website, but there is no software or IT system that runs Basecamp. And so the Basecamp program is actually very excited about the opportunity to have a new e-procurement system where we have visibility into all the data.
Good, thanks.
Perfect. Any other questions? Oh, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Yeah, I have a million questions. So typically, you got an $8 million contract with Periscope. That's going to be paid. What if we back out? I mean, Periscope's put a lot of work into it. It doesn't perform like you do. Are you going to owe the $8 million or a vast portion of it?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer, it's my understanding that we would not. But like Barry and I have mentioned, we have not negotiated this public-private partnership yet. We have an offer from Periscope, and we're bringing the offer forward to discuss with members of this committee and members of the legislature generally. And if we were to obtain support for that partnership, then we would go forward and make sure we were negotiating in the very best interest of the state. If we don't have a deal that we can stand behind, we would not enter into the deal.
And Co-Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer, as I mentioned, we do not have to do that funding model. Right. The meat of this bill is actually about doing something which has been a pilot in Oregon for the last 3 years, and it actually takes an important shared service that all agencies do and actually creates an efficiency so they're all doing it similarly rather than doing what we often do in state government, which is allowing every agency to do things that they have in common differently, which actually creates expense and inefficiency. So we can do the e-procurement system, the reverse auction, and the RFP criteria without doing this funding model. If that makes everyone really uncomfortable, we do not have to go forward with that. And I think that's what's probably making folks the most uncomfortable, and we don't have to do that.
And how many other states are doing a fee that's 1% that your vendors are going to pay?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer, I don't have that data with me today. I can look for the data, but I know there are a significant number of states that fund their e-procurement system through a transaction fee.
Just one follow-up. If we don't pass this, I know you've done a lot of work on it. Mm-hmm. I don't feel I have the time to totally understand it and to see the pitfalls. And I've been through these shared agreements before where you're paying a percentage and they're putting up front in the cost. Generally, they haven't worked out real well. But if we don't pass this today, what's that do to you with all the work? And can it be stalled till the full session?
Representative Smith, Senator DeBoer, what would happen is the pilot project would move forward as it is. We would not have the funds until the long session to be able to come back with a POP to ask for the funds to implement this in a traditional way. There would be some work done through the pilot project that would be unnecessary if we were doing a enterprise implementation. For example, by October, there will be an interface built between the Periscope product and ORPN. If we were doing this in an enterprise solution, we wouldn't need that interface, for example.
So there's some redundancies.
So, Senator DeBoer, any more questions?
Oh, there's lots of them, but I won't. So I'll spare everybody.
Senator Johnson.
Who owns that interface? Is there licensing, or is there proprietary data? Or if this relationship goes sour, as you're building things out without the adequate safeguards, I want to know how in the thrall of Periscope are we if this relationship sours?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, the interface would be owned by the state of Oregon. The Periscope solution is a software as a service, and any of the state's data is stored in a hosting facility that is secure. Our state CIO's office, it's gone through the stage gate process and it's received security clearance, the hosting facility that Periscope uses.
Okay.
Okay. Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, while you were gone, I just reiterated that the three tenets of this bill can move forward without the funding model. We can do this without that funding model. If that is really uncomfortable to folks, we can do what we do, the traditional IT funding models we do in Oregon, and not try a different approach. But the bill is not about the funding model. It's about the tenets of this, of creating some efficiency in procurement.
So what we're going to do really quick, gang, and I apologize for those who have traveled a little bit. We're going to just take about a 5-minute recess and figure out what our next steps are going to be on this. So why don't we just stand in recess for a few minutes? As everyone knows, we're on Senate Bill 1565. We're in a work session. We're going to garner a little bit more information on this. I think there's a good amount of interest in this, and we want to make sure we do it correctly. And so we're gonna gather that information and then come back to this issue in the future. So with that said, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1565, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 4139 relating to the taxation of certain heavy equipment. Where'd Representative Barreto go? Did we lose him?
Oh. I never saw him.
All right, we've lost Representative Barreto. Is he out in the hall? No. Ryan, come on up. Ryan Neal. Ryan is a constituent of House District 57 in Morrow County, and so I've asked if he would just share a few words on this piece of legislation. So welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
No problem. Good afternoon. Co-chairs Smith and Manning and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Neal, and I'm with the Port of Morrow. We're the second largest port in the state of Oregon. Given the Port of Morrow's location on a main interstate and maritime transportation corridor, we're always looking to facilitate the efficient movement of goods and services. The growth of our traded sectors, industries in Oregon, and the development of several industrial parks in our port. HB 4139-A, a bipartisan revenue-neutral tax reform bill, brings much-needed market efficiency to Oregonians, as well as help to our recruited companies as they plan their project costs. With the implementation of HB 4139-A, contracts, owners, and rental companies will all have better information on the tax portion of the cost of heavy equipment rentals. The problems with business personal property tax are widely acknowledged. HB 4139-A will provide market efficiency by allowing growth industries to accurately plan for the cost of rental equipment related to projects at our port. Currently, business personal property tax on mobile equipment creates uncertainty, meaning contractors and owners at Port of Morrow have no way of knowing what portion of their rental costs are attributed to tax. This bill will allow our port and companies we work with to negotiate accurate prices for heavy equipment, ensure the best, most cost-efficient process for the public and private parties. Just as many states and other policy organizations have recognized, HB 4139-A is a common sense approach to allow government and the tax system to work better for both the private sector and the public sector.
Perfect. Thank you, Ryan. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
That's excellent. All righty. I know Representative Barreto wanted to testify on this, but we may have to grab him another day. So, colleagues, is there anyone else who wanted to share any thoughts on House Bill 4139? Phil, can you do one last double check to make sure? Because I know before we exit out. Did you? Okay. I just hate for him to miss that chance. We're going to give it 30 seconds, then we'll adjourn, gang. There you go. There you go.
While you're doing that, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Is Representative Barreto, I assume he's in favor of this.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Gang, that's our agenda for today. And so we're not going to move House Bill 4139. We're going to hold that over. And we'll wait for more information on Senate Bill 1565. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 4139. Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for letting me hold the gavel today. I owe you one. And colleagues, we're done for the day, right?
One question before you.
Did I miss something?
No, are we meeting again? Or
today?
Not today. But
not today.
My understanding is that
Ever.
Oh, we're meeting again.
Representative Beretta. Right
My gavel did not come down.
Yeah, we're stalling.
It did not come down.
We're stalling, yeah.
That was a click of my phone. Well, and so
my staff said they're asking before you're done the committee.
That was my watch hitting down on here.
Okay, so is the bill up? I introduced myself and... Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Manning and Smith and members of the committee. I'm here to bring you House Bill 4139. And this is really a very simple bill, and it takes, right now, the rental companies, when they rent a piece of equipment, it goes from their operation out into the different areas of their distribution. And so the way that personal property tax works is they are responsible for paying personal property tax on that equipment, evaluating it, and then locating it on January 1st, wherever it is. They are responsible for paying personal property tax on that equipment to that location where it is. And I didn't even know that before this before I was asked to introduce this bill. I just thought it was, look, this equipment is spread around. They have to locate it. They have to get an evaluation on it and then fill out their forms. And then the interesting thing is on January 1st, wherever that equipment is, that's where the personal property payment is made in that county for the rest of the year. And so it's an annual thing. It seems kind of messed up, you know, to have it like that. You know, I have a manufacturing company. We pay personal property tax on all of our equipment, but it stays stationary. And, you know, my question was, if I have a company truck and I park it in Portland on January 1st, you know, do I pay personal property tax over there? No, I don't. So it's a little bit unique, I think, to this industry. But all they're asking is to simplify the process and to pay basically a portion of their receipts instead of the personal property tax on this. It would be a revenue-neutral bill. But it would certainly simplify their process of paying this tax. So Representative Smith introduced an amendment to the bill. So it would be pro rata, you know, wherever that equipment is, if it goes into a different county and a portion of that tax is then owed to that county, I think the way it's written is, after a two-year period, it would be evaluated on average of what these counties, different counties in the surrounding area, would be compensated as their portion of this tax, and then pro rata it would be distributed out. But that would be, I think, set after a two-year period when this personal property tax is then turned into a receipt of the sales. It would be reconciled after 2 years and say, does this make sense? We don't want to pay any more, any less, but we want it to be revenue neutral. So it's a fair spread, but it's a simple process for them to pay their tax. So,
perfect, Senator.
Who's the them that you when you talk about reconciling this between two jurisdictions?
Sure.
For example, is it the clerks who the tax assessor who does it?
It is in the counties. The tax assessor in the county. The them would really be the different counties, you know, and what portion is owed or distributed to those counties from the place of business, you know, where the rental operation is. So, for instance, Eastern Oregon Rentals has four locations, I think, down in Ontario, LeGrand, Baker City, Pendleton, and they rent their equipment all over, plus it changes from store to store. I mean, there's some of their equipment they shift from stores to store. But say they had a large piece of equipment that they rented to the Port of Morro from Pendleton. Well, on January 1st, that piece of equipment over in the Port of Morro, the property tax would go to Morro County. And so that's where they have to figure all of this out on January 1st, where all the equipment is, and then pay the different counties accordingly. And so they're saying, can we just simplify this process, pay a portion of each receipt we have, 2%, reconcile it after 2 years to see if that averages out to their personal property tax, and then the allotment as far as where it's distributed. So
could be rectified if there are discrepancies after the 2 year period.
That's correct.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Representative, then I'll come to Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. The members of the committee received an email today from the County Assessor's Legislative Committee expressing some pretty serious concerns with the bill. So I don't know if you've seen that email or... It says this bill is far from being revenue neutral, with potentially millions of dollars being exempted from the county's tax rolls. County residents will see their property tax bills increase due to the value being removed from general obligation bond rate calculations. County treasurers will have added administration by having another district tax distribution to process. Districts will potentially be losing thousands of dollars in tax revenue. This bill will potentially harm all Oregon counties and their residents. So I'm just curious.
So, Co-Chair
Smith. Two sides of every story.
Yeah, Representative Fahey. No, but the county assessors did come in and testify when it was when this bill was heard in the House, and really that was my first understanding that of how this property tax works. And I think that was Representative Smith's amendment, was to try and correct that so that they didn't get shorted for the amount of money that typically ends up in their counties from the way this personal property tax is distributed right now. And so the idea is, over a two-year period, when this is reconciled, you would come up with a certain amount that has been distributed to those counties in the old system, and then how does it look in the new system, so that no one is shorted and it's a fair and equal distribution. But if there are still
Representative,
some...
Representative, let me add on that really quick, because I want to bring some perspective to what you're sharing. In Morrow County, that has had a booming economy, this has a revenue impact of less than $14,000. And with the amendment that we're introducing, it really does become revenue neutral. And so I think you've done a good job with that.
It sounded like they were aware of the amendment and were still... had concerns.
Yeah, I just want to put in perspective, though, we're not talking millions and millions of dollars. Again, in Morrow County, I would argue probably one of the fastest growing industrial counties in the state. Over the last 5 years, the impact is negligible.
Yeah, and Representative, or Co-Chair Smith, Representative Fahey, I think that is one of the things with the two-year reconciliation, is to basically get a better grasp on if this is being, if the numbers are correct, and if it's being dispersed fairly and evenly as it was in the old system. But the thing about it is, the crux of the bill is to try and simplify the system and not make it as complicated as what it is right now.
Any other follow-up? Representative Gumberg.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair. I owe Representative Barreto a lot of hard questions, and I'm going to save those for another time. I just wanted to ask the professional staff, what's this measure doing here? It sounds like a revenue bill.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Smith. Representative Gumberg. I didn't get a chance to introduce this, but actually what happens is the rental entities compile their information and send their tax return and their revenue to the Department of Revenue to process that information, and then the Department of Revenue is sort of the funnel for everything, and then is the redistributor. So Department of Revenue needs funds and positions to make this happen.
Thank you.
And colleagues, I genuinely apologize in my rush to have a constituent come up. I forgot to have LFO walk through what the legislation does, or the bill does, so I apologize for that. Okay. Senator.
Mr. Chair, just a question. So what happens to this bill? Do we meet again? Will we see it again, or is it go somewhere else? Is it dead?
So is it dead? No. Have we received confirmation to move it forward from the co-chairs? Not yet. And so there's lots of time. Any other questions? All right. Any other comments we want to share on this? All right.
Thank you.
Anything? We're good?
Okay. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah,
we
Senator.
May have incoming here.
Okay. Nope, we're good.
Okay.
All right. With that said, we're now going to close the work session on House Bill 4139. Colleagues, thank you for your patience today. It was a little bit of a rough gavel, but we're going to find ourselves adjourned now. So thank you.
Thank you.
You got off the